Welcome to Board Gamers Anonymous, the podcast with board gamers and the insane fun we have at the table together. This is Chris.
And this is Anthony.
And this is episode 325, Talk Me Out of Buying or Backing Mosaic, A Story of Civilization. We'd like to thank all of our Patreon backers for helping us bring you a brand new episode that's all about, dear God, please don't let me back another Kickstarter that's cost $100 because I can't afford to do these anymore, please.
$150 this week. We're going up a little bit.
Yeah, so this week's episode is obviously like every week's episode, which is we talk about the latest and the greatest in board gaming, but we are, in fact, the only board game podcast, the only board game YouTube channel, the only board game Twitch channel, and basically, we are that group of friends that you have that, for some reason, finds the need to back everything, and this week, we're talking about Mosaic, A Story of Civilization that just popped up on Kickstarter, that, as Anthony mentioned, is at $149, and yeah.
It is.
Why? No.
We'll discuss this later. We'll get into it, but I will say this, and I'll mention this more later, but I did get in a Kickstarter today with a ridiculous amount of content that was $80.
Oh.
And it's amazing, and I'm very happy about it. We're going to talk about it in like 2 to 3 weeks. So when something comes up like this, it's $150, I'm like, come on. Just put it in the range where I can make myself say, sure. You put it that high out of, what are you doing?
Yeah. So we will discuss our insane acquisition disorder, extreme FOMO, on our feature review where we, well, I guess as a community, we try to work together to not back this enormously amazing project that is Mosaic, A Story of Civilization. So that's a lot of fun. But obviously, for myself, for Anthony, for many of you, we're getting out and board gaming during this difficult period. Hopefully, all of you are safe. Hopefully, all of you are having fun. And hopefully, all of you are getting games to the table. And again, thank you so much for listening. And, you know, stay safe, because conventions are coming up soon in the future, and we hope to see you all at the table. So, Anthony, obviously, there's a lot going on with us, but let's talk about what's going on with our listeners. What's our question of the week?
Yeah, let's dive right in. This is a fun one. We do this like once a year, but I like to hear what people think about once a year. What criteria do you use to cull your collection, and how often do you do it? And there's a specific reason I'm thinking of this, is because I am currently in the process of moving house. And I have not moved house in 6 years. And when I moved into this home, I had about 100 board games. And right now, according to Board Game Geek, I have about 600 board games, which is, I don't even know if that's accurate. I hope it's not, but it's a large volume, and I need to cut that down by about half. So I'm in the culling process. I don't want to fill half the truck with board games. So I asked our audience, our listeners, our viewers, everybody, how do you do this? What is your criteria? And everybody has their own. So Tim, good friend of the show, says he purchased games when, A, everyone who played felt the game was broken or flawed in some way. Fair. Sure. If everybody who you would bring it to the table with doesn't like it because it's not working, get rid of it.
Yes.
Or B, the target audience he brought it to play with didn't like it, family or gaming group. So even if he kind of likes it, like, I'm the same way. Like, if I like a game and everybody I bring it to play it with is like, nah, I'm like, all right, well, I should get rid of it because I'm never going to play this then. Unless it has a solo mode. There's a couple games like that that have solo modes, or unless it's Spirium, and then everybody can just shut up because they're wrong. I'll hold it until I find people who like it, but I'm similar. I'll get rid of it. David says, I really struggle to purge games, but space at home is becoming an issue. I now ask myself, when can you see yourself playing this next? And if the answer is probably never, it needs to seriously be considered to be moved on. Games need to be played by people, not sit on the shelf. There are some emotional exceptions. I think that last one's important because I do have some games that I keep. My copy of Canterbury from Andrew Parks, I still have that on the shelf. I'm never getting rid of it. It's the first game I kickstarted. It's the first game I went to an event for. Andrew Parks is a good friend. You and I were there, Chris, with other friends. And I'm like, I'm always going to keep that. I have not played it in 7 years. No one wants anything to do with that game, but I'm not getting rid of it. So, and it's a good game. They should play it, but I'm not going to get rid of it for emotional reasons. AC Holt says, I live in an area where it is hard to sell games, and trying to convince someone to pay for shipping is tricky as well. That said, I have a handful of games that either never get played, will never get played, or are just terrible. I do not have a set time for culling, but do so throughout the year, mainly because of space. So this is a common theme. Most people mention space. And then typically the main things that come into play are, can I get other people to play it? That's the main thing. Not do I like it, but will other people play it with me? And is there another game that does this particular thing better? So a few people mentioned that of, you know, I have 4 games. They're all worker placement games about farming. Is one of them better than the rest if I can only get one to the table? Now,
sure,
I should make that consideration because I have like 12 of them and there's maybe 2 or 3 I can get to the table. But I understand people who go through that consideration. I'm going to keep all my Rosenbergs, but some people only need one. So I know, Chris, you've talked about going through this recently yourself, like boxing up some stuff. Is there any criteria that you went through to put things into the boxes?
Whew, that's really hard. I mean, it was a very challenging event to go through. And right. I had tried several times because for me personally, it was an emotional process because, like you said, those games are connected to friends. Those games are connected to game nights. Those games are connected to social experiences that I really enjoy. Board gaming is my social experience, you know, out there in the world. So I work very long hours and I give it my all. So when I do socialize, it is board gaming based. So all of that is just challenging. And then on top of which is the idea that I paid money for these things. And I, you know, as a kid, I grew up and we didn't have money and we didn't have things. And I still don't have money and things, but I do have a substantial board game collection now. And it feels a little weird because before I had a board game collection, I had a little mini movie collection and a little mini book collection. And I still, you know, over the years, one of the challenges is as you move, like as you physically move to different places, inevitably you have to cull from everything. And I remember, you know, after years of going through multiple master's degrees and PhDs, it's like I had this extensive library of books, but every time you move, you just can't take everything with you. It's just too heavy. It's too expensive. There's not enough boxes. And it's just, it breaks your heart every time. So the games, again, is the same thing, which is like, these are, for me, collectible experiences like books. You know, they take me back to a time. They provide a world for me. They provide a social engagement for me. And they were expensive. And I treated them with care. So the fact that, you and I, Anthony, we sleeve games. You know, we protect the components. You know, we buy massive Kalex, you know, storage solutions. We buy board game bags to protect the game. Like, the amount of things that we do to protect the games is kind of obsessive because it's a cardboard product.
Right.
Nonetheless, culling the games is difficult. And I think the other problem is that since we did spend money on them, since they do have an emotional connection, since they do have for us, at least for us, some sort of innate quality to them, then it's one of those things where it would pain me just to throw them in the garbage. It would pain me to try to sell them on the market and get like maybe a quarter of what I paid for or what I feel it's valued. And then at the same time, they're highly valuable in some cases where people would pay hundreds of dollars. And sometimes, depending on the right person, they're not worth anything. Like they're just like, I don't know. It's just like Monopoly, right? You're like, oh God, you're killing me. So it's a very weird situation where for me, I've never sold a board game. I don't know how to do that at this point. I don't know if I want to do it because I don't want to get involved in that because I feel like that's a slippery slope where now you're speculating on Kickstarters and you're trying to flip things. And I have friends that do that. So I'm always like, oh, good for you. I could never do that because there's an insanity behind that. I don't want to go past that curtain. So I did, for the very first time, as you mentioned, Anthony, I boxed a large section of my games that was difficult to do. And I did use a lot of our listeners' criteria. So there were some games that I just felt were not good games. Not necessarily broken, but just not good games. Like, I would play them like, this is just not very good. And there's no way I could substantially, like, it didn't have the emotional appeal or the financial, like, this is just not a great game. Not a bad game, but not great. So that was, like, let's say one third of my collection that I culled. Then probably another third, as you mentioned, is like, would anyone even play this? Like I have some games that are just like a box of minis with like, you know, a dozen pages of like rule sets and stuff. And I'm like, is anyone going to really want to sit down and go through this? No. So that kind of gets the heave-ho kind of thing. And then obviously there are those games that are either problematic because of the theme, problematic because they require a special player count or a special player group, or they're oddly shaped in some cases and they just don't fit. Or like you mentioned, and I really haven't done this in any kind of detail, but it does come down sometimes to, I have a game that's very similar to this in so many different ways. Why am I holding on to this particular version? I have better versions of this. So theme never really, like, initially I was like, when I started getting into board games, I was like, oh, I should have one sci-fi game, one fantasy game, one farming game. And then now it's like you said, we have like a dozen Rosenbergs. So I'm like, how much farming do I really want to do in my life?
Right.
Like, what am I preparing myself for? Like, what do I think the future is going to be like, you know? But nonetheless, there is that situation where, you know, I do have enough miniature games, enough take that games, enough games that like the other versions are better than that. So I do think, like, I did break one of the kind of cardinal rules, I guess, a little bit, which was initially I was starting to collect designers, right? Like, so I, all the Felds or all the Rosenbergs or all those things. And I still kind of hold to that in a way. But at this point, I'm like, this is just not a good game in his collection. So why am I holding on to this? Like, right. I'm never going to play this. I like saying I have the majority of his stuff, but I'm never going to play this. This is not a good game. I can mentally let go of that. I can let the completionist of me go and move on. So I do have four very large boxes. I'm hoping that there's another charity event that we can pull together maybe by the end of the year. Maybe COVID is more tame at that point, so that we could do some good with the games that we have to offer. So that also helps me cull. Like,
yeah.
I could help people, or yeah. I could give these games away to friends. Like, I have a list of games now. Like, again, the shipping is the problem right now because I don't get out to game nights, and shipping is like, hey, would you like a free game? It's going to cost $40 for me to ship it to you. It's like, well, that's the price of the game. If I bought it new, I'm like, oh yeah. But once I get back into the world, my spreadsheet will be available to friends and, you know, whatever people want. I would rather give a game away than sell a game. It's just not worth the money. It's not worth the money, you know, the small amount of money you would get for it, for the aggravation that you have to go through. And I commend the people who do it, but like for the 2 hours to box, to sit online, to mail it, the addresses, the PayPals or whatever else, just take the game. Like, you know, you just do it. Yeah. And I think the funny thing too, Anthony, is that, you know, all of these challenges happen every day when we look at our collections. But honestly, the one problem, and I'm going to bring this back because just honestly, I have to say this. We have complained because we've done the podcast for like 8 years now. And we've said time and time again, dear God, please stop producing games that are like this many components, like a handful of components in a giant box. And everyone's like, well, it's cheaper, it's easier for us, you never know, why are you complaining, it's got shelf appeal. And we're like, yeah, no, shelves don't do any more appealing. There's the right. The day of the friendly local game store is in the sunset of its days, right? You can put a picture up it online. A game doesn't sell because it has a big box. A game always sells because it's a good game,
right?
I don't have room to buy more games. So if you're a publisher out there and you're not making the money you think you should be making, it's because the games that are out there are taking up half to two thirds of my space, empty board game boxes. It's driving me nuts.
Yeah. I will say that's true. My number two game of all time is Root. It comes in a box like this big. It is packed full of content. Pack it. Pack it full, guys. Pack it.
And if you wanna have expansions, when the expansion comes out, make a box that's big enough to hold the main game and the expansion. But don't come out with these giant core boxes that has like five components in it. You're killing us.
It's too much. It's too dang much. Yeah. Yep. No, I'm with you, man. Like, I have a whole closet full of stuff. I made a list. I had prices on it. And then, like, I hit the point where I'm like, I'm not going to ship these. I'm not going to track people down to sell them. So I shared it with all my friends. And I'm like, who wants games? If you don't live in Pittsburgh, pay for shipping. I don't care. Please get these out of my closet. Because if I get to the point, like, in July when I'm about to move and they're still in my closet, I have to get rid of them. I don't know where they're going to go. Please take them off my hands. So
sure. Yeah. Again, it's part of the hobby that we often don't talk about, and we appreciate everyone hitting us up with that. And again, there's a lot of really good ways to do that. So not to mention, if you have really great games that you want to get rid of, I'm just saying, I'll take them. Just saying, that's fine. I'll take them. I always looking forward to having some more great games in my collection. Right. So a lot of fun. All right. So again, thank you all for hitting us up on Facebook and Twitter. The question of the week, in fact, the question of the day, comes out every day on Facebook and Twitter. Of course, BoardGamersAnonymous.com is our world famous website. In fact, I just showed it off to a couple of big publishers, and they were pretty shocked that that was actually a thing. That there are not just podcasts, not just YouTube channels, not just Twitch, not just TikTok, not just Instagram, but you know, there are actual websites that have all of this content on there.
There is owned media out there. We own it. We run it. We post it. Please read it.
Yeah. So please go on to check out the website. You'll be surprised. It has a lot of great content out there. And we're always looking for more. So if you ever want to create some content and you want to put it on a website, we're looking forward to it. All right, everyone. So that's what's going on with you. Again, thank you so much for hitting us up. And thank you so much for sharing our question a week with so many people. It's some really good conversation to get out there, and just some general good support to let everyone know what's going on in board gaming. All right, Anthony, so that's what's going on with our listeners. Let's talk about what's going on with us. Let's talk about our question of the week, and then moving on to our acquisition disorders.
All right, I got something digital this week. Chris, you actually shared this with me this morning.
I did.
I was like, I'm in. I want this. And that is Oink Games Plus. This is
crazy.
A Kickstarter running right now to play Oink games on your Nintendo Switch. I've had a Nintendo Switch since it launched in 2017, a little over 4 years now. I have played several board games on here. It's become like quite the popular platform after Steam to port board games onto. And this is a Kickstarter to put a bunch of Oink games onto the Nintendo Switch. So the initial two that they're targeting are Deep Sea Adventure, which is their biggest hit. I think they've said they've sold 200,000 copies of the physical version of this game, which is crazy to me because getting this outside of Japan is very difficult. You can really only get it at a convention. Occasionally an online site gets copies in and they're kind of marked up like $30, $40 for this little tiny box. But Deep Sea Adventure is very good. It's a very solid press your luck kind of game. You're diving down. You have to get back. It's like Clank without all the junk around it. It's just get down there, get back first, and survive. That's it. Deep Sea Adventure. I had a lot of fun with it. I played it at a couple conventions. I really enjoy it.
I own
the
a
second
copy.
Game. Oh, I need a copy, man. the second game is Startups, which it's funny because they say, an online review site made this game really popular. It's Shut Up and Sit Down. They talked about 10 Oink games is one of the ones they talked about, and it made it really popular. So they sold a lot of copies of Startups. But the basic idea is there are six different companies. People invest in them, and you're trying to like develop. It's like a basic economic game because Oink games all come in tiny little boxes. Mm-hmm. It's cute little artwork, lots of fun little stuff. So like one of them is like Hippo Power Tech. It's like a hippopotamus with like a little plug sticking out of its butt. It's cute. It's fun. And so that's the second one. The other two that they have listed that are not unlocked yet are Moon Adventure and A Fake Artist Goes to New York. And A Fake Artist Goes to New York was like their big popular game before Deep Sea Adventure came out. It hasn't sold quite as many copies, but it's like a Pictionary type of thing with like more gamified than normal. They've also listed In a Grove, which is another game about people or witnesses in a crime scene, and your goal is to find the murderer. So kind of like a group deduction type of game. And then they have another 6 stretch goals they haven't revealed yet, which I'm pretty sure are just going to be more games, because Oink Games has done like 20, 25 games. A lot of them are perfect for digital, and why would they not do that? So the basic idea here is you back this at there's a 2,500 yen level, which is like $23 US, and you get a download code for Oink Games Plus, and that's going to include any of the games to get unlocked here. So right now, I don't think they've even hit their limit yet. So their goal is 27,000, which is like 300,000 yen, and they're at like 14,000, but this just went up today. So it'll probably hit it. So once they hit that, they unlock those first two games, and then each 100% they go over that, they unlock another game. So the higher they go, the more games get unlocked. And I'm excited. I think a lot of these will be a lot of fun. Some of them are supposedly going to work locally. I think A Fake Artist Goes to New York kind of has to work locally. So
sure,
we'll see how that works. So if they get like 5, 6, 7, up to 10 games on here, I will 100% be in at like a $23 for that, for, you know, 10 Oink games, which are typically like $30, $40 each to get physical copies of. I'm all about that. So keep your eye on that. There is options on here as well to get in on the beta early. To get back that, you get on the beta. You can also pledge for physical rewards, because they just did a physical Kickstarter back in February for their newer game set. So if you want like physical copies of their newest games, you can do that as well. So if you've never played an Oink game, check them out. They're amazing. This is like huge conventions, because they always have a booth at like the big conventions. They're hard to get outside of that, but every one of these I've played, I've had fun with. Even if I don't own them, I enjoy them. So Oink Games Plus, hopefully coming to Nintendo Switch at the end of the year. I will have it saved right now. I will back it if they unlock a couple more games.
Yeah, I don't own a Switch, but this was something I was really excited about, because, as you said, I do like their little games. Some are better than others. Deep Sea Adventure is definitely a hit. A friend of mine had it. I played it, and I was like, oh, I definitely want to own that. And again, it's one of those games that is so nicely, neatly packed in this little tiny box. And it's, you know, it's whatever it is, 4 inches by 2 inches, whatever. And it's just a good game. It's just a normal press your luck game. And it gets a lot of attention. It gets a lot of game time with that. So their other games are good, too. I haven't played all of them, not even near all of them. And like you said, we have only seen them at conventions. Their Kickstarters are up. They're fairly expensive, because you are getting a game shipped pretty far away. So
yeah,
Japan. This is a good option. I like this. This is really a good option. All right, so I'm going to talk about another Kickstarter that's currently up that is an interesting option. It's called Ice. This is a current Kickstarter that has already backed, surpassed its goal, and it's will back completely on Monday, May 31st, 2021, of course. Now, ice, or according to its description here, snow, as far as the eye can see, lead your archaeological expedition to uncover artifacts, exploration, tile mining collection. Now, this is the first game from a company called This Way. This is their first created game, and it's a company that's been formed by two brothers. And again, I know this seems odd, and this is reminds me of way back in the day where the only games that were really kickstarted were games that really needed to be kickstarted, where they just didn't have the funding. They were mom and pop kind of company, or in this case, two brothers kind of company, and they really needed people's support in order to make these things happen. Now, in particular, what drew my attention to this game was a couple of different things, but the artwork here is unique and outstanding. It's atmospheric. It's very different than usual. It's something that I think just that alone is worth your time and attention. Leonardo D is the illustrator, and the graphic design, Alexis V, also beautiful job here. So I recommend taking a look at the game, if for no other reason from the artwork. I think the artwork is a sight to behold. It really does give you the thematic feel and appeal as if you were kind of mining down in this wondrous kind of ice cavern. Now, the game itself is interesting because you do have your own particular leader, and everyone is utilizing archaeologists and miners and support and camps to be able to dig down into the ice. This is a really interesting part of the game because basically what you're looking at is the game board is this giant ice sheet. It comes in four separate parts, and each of the parts is a different level deeper. So what you're looking at is about 5-6 levels deep, and each of them are like these hexagon kind of tiles. And what you're doing is you are having your miners and your archaeologists, you know, crack through the ice, find these rare artifacts, which are just on the other side of the tile, and then add them to your display because they're going to give you special powers and abilities, but also unique things will happen throughout the game. So you go through that first level, and then there's more below it. And, you know, you could see people are digging through the ice in different parts of the board. You have to be careful because ice can fall in. You could lose, you know, your miners. You could lose your archaeologists. You could even lose your team leaders to have to go back to the board. So it's a very interesting, different game. And I love the idea that there's multiple levels to this player board as you dig through. And there are different guilds. And these different guilds have the opportunity to build together based upon their artifacts that they collect to gain special powers throughout the game. So each of these hexagon tiles will have different abilities, different effects, different things that come about, and you're showing off all of these different resources that you're able to pick up throughout the game. So as you dig, you're seeing like, wow, look, there's an artifact, but it's kind of covered by ice. Oh, you dig a little deeper. Oh, I could see it a little bit clearer. And then you dig even deeper, and now you actually have the artifact itself, whether it's inactive or activated in the game. And eventually, you finally get to the bottom and you're able to locate really the goals of the game because there are decree cards in the game, what the game wants you to do. There are special request cards because you're looking for certain kind of artifacts in the game. It's just a really smart, beautiful little game. I don't know if it has the complexity to kind of hold your interest long term, but it has a lot of different game modes. So you could play it in a lot of different ways. So this campaign is currently up, and it might be something you might be interested in. I recommend taking a look at it. Again, this is a first-time designer, so we are always a little cautious when we see something like this. But again, it looks like all the artwork is complete. The game board is complete as far as that's concerned. There are multiple backing levels. Most of the backing levels are to receive additional artwork. But you could pick this game up for about $100, or you can go even a little further and pick it up for $120, again, if you want to pick up the extra stuff. That is Ice. It's available right now. So take a look on Kickstarter.
I was like, oh, that sounds cute. It sounds fun. It sounds interesting. And then you said the prices and I was like,
yeah, that's your first time designer price. I think that's part and parcel of the kind of situation so that they money. Are. It is a lot of money. And it's not an American release, obviously.
Right.
But again, what we have to remember is you are typically paying for the artwork.
Right.
You can't, that's the challenge of a game. When Anthony and I got into board gaming, Anthony, you know this, it was always like, why are these games $40, $50, $60? And it was like, the artwork is terrible, but the components are terrible. Like, but the mechanics are brilliant. And now it's like, the mechanics are good, but the artwork is exceptional, right? Like, yeah. You put a lot of money into the artwork and you're like, should I still buy this? So, yeah. So again, I think it's something to take a look at, whether it reaches your particular needs or goals. But I think it would be a mistake to just overlook it because it is a first-time designer. And a lot of times, a lot of these big board game companies just kind of swallow up all the attention based on their kind of big campaigns.
Right.
All right. So that's every game that we've talked about ours or our acquisitions. Anthony, let's get to the games that hit the table. And we'll let those people know if those games are a buy and they should run out and pick those games up. If those games are a play and they should sit down and play them. If those games are a dodge and they should avoid them. Or if those games are a burn and maybe they should just be buried at the bottom of an ice sheet. So what do you have for us this week?
All right. Yeah, I have a simple one, a quick one. It is called Agropolis. This is the follow-up to Sprawlopolis, which is one of my favorite. Well, it is my single favorite button-shy game. And I don't want to hear it, Chris, about the button-shy games.
Come on, man! They're amazing.
But Sprawlopolis is legitimately one of my favorite solo games of all time. I can play it in about 5 minutes, and whenever I pull it out, I'll play it 5 times, right? Just back to back. It's amazing. So Agropolis went up on Kickstarter about 3 months ago, because that's the turnaround time in Button Shy games. You back it, and within 3 months, you get a copy. It's amazing. And sure. It is, they say it's not like an expansion. It's more of like a spiritual successor. And that's true, because it's not a direct expansion to Sprawlopolis. There is an expansion that comes with Agropolis that allows you to combine them, called Combopolis. So you can play both games together. But generally, you play this on its own. So instead of Sprawlopolis, which has like your residential, your commercial, your industrial locations, this is farming locations. So you have, you know, like orchards and wheat fields and livestock pens and vineyards. And they kind of follow the similar rules that you have in Sprawlopolis. And so just real quick, how that game works is you have a deck of 18 cards. You're going to take 3 of them. You're going to flip them face over. And on the other side, you're going to have 3 scoring conditions. And that's what you're trying to accomplish in the game. And then you're going to have 3 cards at a time. And I'm talking about the solo rules here. This does play with 2 players, but it's primarily a solo game. Mm-hmm. You will then place 1 card at a time. There's like a starting card that goes on the center of the table. And you just kind of build off from there. And you can place them either adjacent or overlapping any of the 4 little rectangles on each of the cards. There are roads on every card, and so every road that you build on your opolis, whether it's Agropolis or Sprawlopolis, is a negative point in the game, right? So every road in the system costs you something. But so, you know, you're trying to combine as many roads as you can, but there's also other conditions, right? You get points for the largest group of each type of terrain. So in this case, the largest group of orchards or wheat fields or livestock pens or vineyards. And then the 3 scoring cards give you special scoring conditions. And so there's 18 of those that come in each in the game period, right? And they're going to be different every time because you're only drawing 3 of them. So it might be, you know, you get 2 points for every road that runs adjacent to a vineyard and -1 point for every road that runs adjacent to a pig pen, right? So you have to kind of maneuver where the roads go. Make sure they're all next to the vineyards and not next to the pig pens. The reason this one's different from Sprawlopolis is that the tiles themselves vary, right? So in the original game, you had those 4 types of locations, and that was basically it. There weren't a lot of tweaks except the mini expansions. In this one, you have the pens are all different. So it can be all the different types of livestock. There's pigs, there's chickens, there's cows, and then they're split in half on each of the cards. But then there's also different types of, you know, orchards or wheat fields or vineyards or whatever. So there's variability on the individual cards. And then you have kind of the overall value that you're trying to target. So the 3 cards that you pull out that are your scoring conditions, you add up the value at the top of each of those cards. And that's what you're trying to target as a solo player. Like if you hit that score, you win. If you get below that, you lose. If you get negative points, you're me. And you keep playing, right? So you get a lot of negative scoring games. And so that's a lot of fun because you get just ridiculous variability. The game plays really quickly. It is very brain-burning. It's difficult to get these things. Like you have the 3 scoring conditions, but each of them is like, do this, but not this. So you have 3 things telling you to do X, but not Y. And then the base game telling you to do X, but not Y, because you have to build the largest sections, but then not have too many roads. So you have like 4 of these different like if then statements in your head, and you're trying to overlap all of them, and you almost always mess it up. You're like, all right, cool. I got 5 groups of big vineyards. It's great. I got a ton of points from that. And you're like, nah, I got like 13 roads though. Like that's negative 13 points. Great. I got 0. So it's a lot of fun. I don't feel like it's super different from Sprawlopolis. You know, that's the goal. Obviously, you want more content, more variability, more engagement with the core mechanics that is Sprawlopolis. And it's different, and I will play it separately, but it feels the same. You know, if they were going for a different feeling in the game, like this is a different game with the same core idea, I don't think they quite got there. It feels like Sprawlopolis with another expansion layered on top. Now, I have not played the Combopolis, combining the two, which I feel like might take it to the next level, because then you have cards from both sets and scoring conditions from both sets. But all that said, I love this system. Sprawlopolis is one of my favorite games of all time. It was in my top 100 when we did that in December. So this is definitely a buy, because if you can get a copy to convention or off their website, it's like $10. So 1000% pick it up. If you prefer the urban setting, pick up Sprawlopolis, also amazing. There's 4 or 5 mini expansions for that game. There's 2 or 3 mini expansions for this game. But the core system, the Sprawlopolis system that we have here in Agropolis, so good. If you're looking for a solo game that you can carry in your pocket and play in 5 minutes, this is the one. Like, if, in my opinion, it's the one you should own. So check it out. Agropolis, it's a buy.
Wow, that's high praise if this is the one. Is this the one out of all the button flies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
And I wouldn't say Agropolis over Sprawlopolis, because I think it's more of a theme preference. Like, if you don't want a farming game, get the city game. Honestly, I would say get both of them and throw them together. But, yeah, it's really, really good. They have a lot of really good games, Buttonfly, but Sprawlopolis is their best game, especially if you're a solo player. So definitely check it out.
Yeah, and I make a joke about that, because, again, it's one of these little games, the little it's a little kit with a little button. And it's kind of funny, because that's how I think about it. Like you said, it's like something you put in your jeans pocket, you know, like the Buttonfly jeans. And here you have a little game with the Buttonfly. But these button shy games, you know, it's one of those situations where they're like the Oink games a lot, right? Like, they are very small games. They're, I wouldn't say inexpensive, but fairly inexpensive for that kind of game experience that you can have for them. Yeah, I mean, these are like $12 each. I know that they were on Kickstarter at some point. I just always feel like, is the still the time? Like you said, this is a very like unique situation. Like, you're out on your own. Maybe you go to a cafe and you just want something you could throw down the table. This works, right?
Yeah.
So that might work perfectly well for that kind of scenario. Maybe for something else, like trying to get to game night, you could play this with more people. So that kind of thing. Yeah. As far as like the agriculture side, not my thing. You know, I don't necessarily want to put together a horrible collection of roads and agriculture things. But like you said, maybe Sprawlopolis would be more my thing as far as like that kind of interest is concerned.
Yeah, I think you'd like that one. I don't think you'd like Agropolis, because it doesn't do enough differently to warrant it like having this over the other one, if you prefer the other theme. But yeah, I've taken this on airplanes, I've taken it on trains, I've taken it to coffee shops, I've played it while watching TV, because I can set it up and play it in 5 minutes.
Sure.
Honestly, it's the kind of game where, like, if I'm like, I really want to play a game right now, and I also really want to go to bed in 20 minutes, this is the game I'll pull off the shelf, because I'm like, I can just play it real quick and then put it away. And the put away time is zero, because it's just a deck of cards. You swipe it all together and you throw it away. And so I've probably played Sprawlopolis more times in the last year, year and a half than any other game, because of how quickly I can play it. So more of that, muy bueno.
Well, we didn't plan it this way, but my game this week is very similar to your game this week. I'm talking about a game that's quick to play. It's a two-player game, and this is the faster version of already fast games. So this is Patchwork Express. So probably for many of you, you already know Patchwork, so I'm going to add a little bit more information on Patchwork Express if you've already played Patchwork. But again, Patchwork Express and Patchwork and all the different variations of the game are primarily about building or constructing or sewing together, I guess is probably the best way to say it, a patchwork quilt utilizing polyominoes. So Anthony's always like, Chris doesn't like polyominoes. I do like polyominoes when it's a really good game. So this is my exception to the rule. This is my exception where the game works out really well. In fact, you know, I'm showing on camera. So again, if you are watching or listening to this on our YouTube channel on Friday, you'll actually get to see, hey, look, it's Patchwork. I actually own a copy. See? Polyominoes live. And then, you know, now the reason why I'm showing Patchwork here, and again, it's a very small box. You know, this is a game that you can get, you know, out to the table, lookout games. And this is a game that for me was obviously a buy. And this was a game that shot up to the charts, especially because this is an Uwe Rosenberg game. And for me, this is the best version, for me, the best version of his Polyominoes games. Now, the reason why I'm showing you Patchwork, if you're watching the video, and if you're not, follow along, because nonetheless, it's true, is because I did put Patchwork and Patchwork Express in the same box. Because again, I wanted to keep every box, every board game box, even the expansions, but the industry broke me, so now we're sticking things together, and I'm living that kind of life now. It's not cool, I'm not happy with it, but it's how I have to live now, all right? So, two games in one box, not happy about it. But in fact, one of the things I did do in order to remind myself is the back of the box is Patchwork Express. Ah, so I've actually done this with CV. I have CV and Civilization. I stuck that in the same box too. So why I'm showing this, because visually I think you need to see this. And if you're just listening to this, I'm gonna explain the primary difference. Patchwork has smaller polyominoes of more unique shapes. Patchwork Express has larger polyominoes with simpler shapes. In fact, the games are identical, with the exception of Patchwork Express is a board that's the same size, but the spaces are bigger because here, again, the pieces are bigger and they're simpler. In fact, when you play Patchwork Express, after you go around, there's five tiles left, you put in these very simple blue tiles that are very simple shapes, mostly squares and rectangles and things like that, that you can easily finish out your design. Other than that, there's no 7x7 rule in order to get like bonus, you know, buttons in ore. And the board itself, as far as circling around in order to get the additional patches, is a lot simpler, a lot quicker, and you get a lot more patches. So it's a lot quicker, easier, simpler of a game to get to the table to play with any number of people. This obviously plays better for people who don't play hobby board games or for kids, because they can obviously be able to utilize it a lot better than anything else, right? Because the other polyomino, they could still do it. It's not that they couldn't do it. But nonetheless, this allows for a quicker, simpler, easier way to engage with the game. And honestly, that's what Patchwork should be. I would love to see a more complex version of Patchwork. I don't know what's the opposite of Patchwork Express. Patchwork, I don't know. Sludge or slowdown or bottleneck, or I don't know what the right, you know, adjective would be there. But nonetheless, Patchwork Express is a buy. It is definitely a simpler game. I do prefer the regular version of Patchwork. There's also a holiday version. I talked about it in an early acquisition during the holiday season. I probably would even prefer that even more, just because it's a little brighter and a little more colorful. So Patchwork Express is a buy. If you either own Patchwork, I recommend getting the other one if you wanted to get it to more people and get it done quicker.
I dig me some Patchwork. I never actually ended up playing this version. I do own a copy somewhere because I thought my kids will like this, but honestly, they play the original version just fine. We got the holiday version over the holidays and they were playing that.
Sure.
So I have not had a chance to play this, but I'm sure they would also like it just fine.
It's all the same stuff, like you said, with Sprawlopolis. And, you know, it's just a different version. It's more of the same, but slightly twisted, tweaked a little bit. So, all right.
Right.
All right. So our feature review this week is one that we have been dreading, because we want to back Mosaic, A Story of Civilization. But thankfully, our feature review is Talk Me Out of Buying or Backing This Game. So for this feature review, I will be talking about the new Kickstarter, Mosaic, from our friends at Forbidden Games. And it is a civilization game that you can get done under 2 hours. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But Mosaic, A Story of Civilization, is an action selection board game where you guide an ancient civilization from its founding to its ultimate fate and history. And just to kind of make it a little obvious and basic, it's Civilization in the Mediterranean. Whoa, big surprise there.
Woo!
Woo! What a radical take there. So, yes. So, again, if you haven't played Civilization games before, typically they are very generally about, again, building up your civilization, utilizing different resources and technology. There is, you know, somewhat a 4X element to it as you are exploring and exterminating and you're building throughout the game. So it has a lot of different elements, and Civilization games are not easy. Like, seriously, they're not easy to put together. They're not easy to get to the table, but they are some of the most satisfying board games out there, because you do feel like you are building up a civilization and you are making dramatic, you know, historical decisions with, you know, tremendously famous leaders and world-changing, you know, military combat. So, Anthony, what do you know about Civilization games? You're a bit of a fan, right?
I love Civilization games. Yeah, no, it's one of my favorite genres of game. The problem is that you get two buckets of Civilization games and then a handful of games that fit in the middle. You've got the ridiculously overly long, super complicated 5,000-bit games, which I don't have a problem with necessarily. I still enjoy them, but it's impossible to play them. So this is like your GMT stuff, like your, you know, Western empires, your Eastern empires, your ancient civilizations of the whatever, you know, your mega civilization, all that stuff. And then you've got your super boiled down, not really a civilization game, but hey, let's use the theme anyways type of games like Tapestry.
That's true.
Or like some of those games I like, Civilization and New Dawn, I really enjoy, even though that's not really a full 4X civilization game. And then a small number fit in the middle, right? You've got Nations, Through the Ages, Clash of Cultures with the new, like the various starting civilizations that you get in the Monumental Edition. Mm-hmm. There's a few, and they work, and they're amazing, but they're narrow, they're often very expensive, and they're also still too long. Nations is one of my favorite games of all time, but I don't play that with other people because it takes 3 to 4 hours, and people don't want to play a 4-hour Civ game. So every year or so, every 12 to 18 months, somebody comes along and they claim, hey, we figured it out. We've got a civilization game. We can do it in 90 minutes. We got this. It's got all the 4 of the X's. You're good to go. And you're like, all right, I'm going to try it. And then you play it and you're like, it's like 1.8 X's. It's not like you got rid of the combat, or you got rid of the technology, or you got rid of the exploration, and then you just boil down to these simple things. And it's still a fine game, but it's not a full Civ game. So that's like, that's where I come into any Kickstarter like this, where they're claiming all these things, where I'm like, is it though? Is it?
And that's going to be one of the questions that you and I have to ask, Anthony, because you and I are big Civilization board game fans, and we own, I think, all of them combined. I mean, Through the Ages is one of both of our favorites. Seven Wonders, obviously, one of our big favorites, and all the different, you know, empire ages of all those things, nations, as you mentioned earlier. So let me talk a little bit about the game and why it's so attractive and why you might want to back the game. So right off the bat, this is from designer Glenn Drover. Now, he's already done Age of Empires 3, which you might have had a chance to play. So that's a solid, significant civilization game. He's also developed Railways of the Road, Raccoon Tycoon, Lizard Wizard, which are not civilization games. But again, it's good that he's gotten some other games out there with Forbidden Games. So what this game looks like, if you haven't seen it yet, is, again, we're looking at the Mediterranean and the surrounding country areas there. You're not controlling one of those civilizations to start off with. Basically, what you're going to be doing throughout the game is building up civilizations on multiple country states out there, nation states out there. And you're going to be dropping different wonders and different cities and different villages out there. Now, basically, your game is all about your own personal game board. So your personal game board will come with or be given out to you a leader card. Now, right now, there are 9 leader cards. I'm hoping that there's more, because what we're looking at is a possibility of a 6-player game. So 9 leader cards is a little thin. Yeah. They don't do the thing, Anthony, that I was really surprised with. They didn't go with historical leaders.
Yeah, it's a weird decision, you know, like... That's like one of the core things. Like, you play Civilization, you got Gandhi yelling at you. That's part of the game, right? This crazy warmongering Gandhi. You're like, what are you doing? But here they're just different roles, right? You got general, magistrate, engineer, scribe. And then they kind of match them up to different civilizations in the artwork.
They do.
But they're not specific people. And I do wonder why they did that.
I don't know. I mean, I like the idea that you could almost play these anywhere, but also at the same time, like you mentioned, they're missing out on kind of entrenching thematically in a certain civilization. These leader cards remind me very much of Kingsburg, where even the artwork and like, hey, here's an artist, here's a philosopher, here's a farmer, here's a miner, right? It's one of those things where it's like, oh, I've seen these before. Now, basically, these leader cards are going to give you starting resources and a special ability or special abilities in the game. They're also, and this is the kind of thing that I think that we need to have a longer conversation another day about the impact of board games on the industry. The leader cards also have a symbol on them. And as we talk about this, a lot of cards have symbols on them and a lot of cards need symbols. So this kind of plays a little bit like Terraforming Mars, where you have to collect the certain number of symbols based upon whatever it is that you're scoring that's going to score you points, or again, collect the number of symbols in order to be able to purchase or employ certain cards. So beyond the leaders are technology cards. Now, Anthony, for me, this is where I love Civ games. I love a tech tree. I love different technologies. I love imagining that my civilization's building up. They did a great job here. 97 technology cards, you know, from things from like astronomy to plants to armor to art, a lot of different variability here. I think this is really where the game makes or breaks, because everything else is kind of basic. It's like, hey, here's population cards, here's building cards, but technology cards, the tech tree is always the most interesting thing for me when I play a civilization game.
100% agree. Yeah, it's honestly the one thing that broke Tapestry for me is the complete lack of theme around the tech tree.
Sure.
Where you could get like space age technology and then after that do nails. You know, it didn't work. And some people are like, oh, come on, you know, you're taking it too seriously. I'm like, it's a Civ game. The point is that you're building up. If you're not building up, then it's not a Civ game. It's just a Civ theme thrown on another game. That's all that game was. So I'm all about the tech tree here, but I guess the problem I have is that I look at like acquisition tiles. They have the wonder tiles, the golden age tiles, the achievement tiles. There's only nine of each, right?
Yes.
And so like, if you look at almost any other game in the wonders, there's usually more than nine. I mean, there's seven wonders of the ancient world, and then you have the whole rest of the world, right? So are we only doing the ancient world? And if that's the case, can we clarify that a little bit? It's not really a Civ game if we're talking about, like, you know, 500 years of antiquity. I don't know. I want more. And that's the problem. Yeah. That is kind of the catch 22 of any Civ game, is you want more, but you don't want it to take 6 hours, right?
Sure.
And so they're building a game that's not going to take 6 hours. They're like, it's only 2 hours. It's going to be quick.
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. And then you look at the list of stuff and you're like, oh, you only got 37 buildings and you only got like these 9 wonders. What are you doing? And they're like, well, if we added more, it would take longer. You're like, yeah, but there's only 9. So,
yeah. And I think from a, like you said, from a design point of view, that where, you know, like we said, the technology cards, a tech tree, like you said, Tapestry. I like the fact that Tapestry did go from like basically prehistoric. I don't know if it was prehistoric, but it was at least early antiquity to like the space age. You don't see that in many games, maybe Civilization, the board game kind of here. This one is certainly not a very long civilization. This is a really kind of short, you know, point in history, like, you know, however many generations it was. But I think you make a perfect point, Anthony, here. The build cards here are generic. The population cards are generic. The tax and tariff, I like to see. That's interesting, because what's interesting about those, the three sets of cards is that they're variable. So you might get a tax that is giving you more money. The next card that flips over to be available might be less successful or less beneficial to you. So I don't know thematically how that makes sense, you know, or like how it makes sense that you can get, you know, additional two population by paying 12 wheat, but later in the game, one population, but you only have to pay 5 wheat. Like, how is that a thing? But nonetheless, again, there's variability as far as that's concerned. But I think the thing that they were looking to do was they were trying to build the wonders, the golden age tiles, which are victory point kind of base tiles, the civilization achievement tiles. Again, those are victory point based upon whatever kind of specialty you're going for. So in order to do a 2-hour system, they very tightly enclosed it on really basic things, right? Like, did you build enough, you know, enough projects or wonders? Did you build enough population? Did you build enough production? You know, did you get enough food? Did you get enough of these symbols, right? We go back to the terraforming Mars, where these golden age tiles should be like amazing. It's like, it's architecture. You needed to have six of those symbols in order to be able to do that. Now you get a bonus, which is great. But again, boiling it down, it's always that question where, like, you want to play something that's playable and available, but at what point do you lose the thematic appeal and you lose the civilization game, right? Like you said, Tapestry, right? At what point did it just go off the rails? And here, right, we're looking at that similar civilization. Like, there's six government tiles. So there's six different governments you can choose from. Again, based upon if you meet the particular conditions, which is very smart. And I love the idea that government's here, because when you play through the ages, I love that the government is really important on what you're able to do and what you're able to build in your population. But here you get six. Again, I don't know. I mean, Anthony, you have a lot of civilization games. Where's the line? Is there a game that really does it well as far as it's playable, but it's still a civilization game? Is like, where does this fit? Where do you feel this fits?
I don't know, man. I don't think anybody's really nailed it yet.
Okay.
Clash of Cultures might be the closest. That game is 2 to 3 hours. And the challenge now with Clash of Cultures is that they printed it. The base game was fine. The expansion was amazing. You could never find the expansion. And now if you want all the content, it's $150 like this thing.
Yep.
So we get in the same stupid boat. Nations is very good, but still a little long with 3 to 4 players. It's now affordable. You can get that game for like $60, $70, which is, I think, acceptable. Sure. I honestly can't get over the price of this game. I just honestly, like, everything you're talking about, the mechanics, I'm like, it's fine. I'm okay with that. I want to play it. I want to try it. And then I just look at the pricing where they're like, this is what the retail is. This is what you get. And I'm just like, no, those numbers are stupid.
Here's the other thing with this game that makes it so very attractive. Now, we didn't mention, I just want to mention ever so briefly, that one of the big parts of this game is obviously picking up resources that are scattered throughout the game. So there are trade goods that are available, and there's different currencies throughout the game. So there are idea tokens that you need in order to do science and technology. There are stone tokens that you need to build stone in order to build buildings, and there are food tokens, obviously, to build a population. This is where Kickstarter is either the greatest thing in the world or just a nightmare, because, as you said, this game is $150 because, of course, they want you to buy all the plastic miniatures and all the coins, you know, all the upgrades for this. And you look at it and you're just like, dear God, these are beautiful 3D sculptures. And with this game, you receive 351 of these. Now, some of these are just figures, right? Some of these are just soldiers and workers and things like that. Some of these are actual wonders. As Anthony mentioned, there's only a couple of those. But that's where this either just, you just fall in love with this game and you want to run out and back it, or you just like are repelled because it's just, again, it's $149. The game, as far as the Civ game is concerned, as we talked about this earlier, the complexity is not really there as far as maybe what you'd want for a Civ game, but the production is certainly there.
Yeah. I mean, so here's how I'm thinking about it, right? So production-wise, this is on par with Twilight Imperium 4th edition. You got about 350 or so miniatures / upgrades, whatever. And that's about the same as TI4, which is also $150.
Yes.
TI4 is one of the best games of all time. Like, it's just hands down, it's 20 years of iteration and optimization and improvement coming from one of the best board game producers in the world.
Sure.
With some of the best molds and all the different pieces, and just it's amazing. The production's amazing. This game is on Kickstarter from a designer we all know and love.
Yes.
Glenn Drover does amazing work. But we don't know anything about this game. We've not played it. We haven't seen it. It looks relatively medium weight. Like, it's giving me like a Goo Gong vibe of like, I would probably enjoy this, but I feel like you're throwing a lot of bling at a game that's probably like a 2.9 on the weight scale. And I'm like, I don't think that's really worth it. And then you're asking me for $150 and you're saying, hey, you get 350 pieces with it. I'm like, great, that's my money's worth, but is the game my money's worth? And I feel like if you're weighing the three different pieces and putting them on the scale, does it all balance out? And this is coming from someone like, when I first saw this, I was like, oh, this looks really cool. I'm like looking at it. It's really getting like really intrigued by it. And then honestly, the thing that got me the most, which is good timing because we're talking about this today on the podcast.
Yeah.
Is my copy of Kemet Blood and Sand came in today, which was $80. And that box is packed and it's got like almost 200 miniatures and pieces in it as well. All the bonuses, the upgrades, the expansions, the game up pieces. I got the mat. I got the expansion that was supposed to be Cthulhu, but now it's not, you know, the sleeves. And I think I spent $105, $110 total for all of that. And that's a game that I've played before and I love, and they've iterated on and made it better. And it will be on my shelf for years. This game, I don't know anything about it, and they're asking for $150. So I'm just like, I know at the end of the day, like we keep coming back to money on these things. And I don't think that's necessarily the beginning or end all of any decision on Kickstarter. Like there's plenty of games I've spent way more money on than I want to because it does certain things really well. But in this case, I just don't see the gameplay, at least what they're showing me, bearing out beyond what I've experienced in other Civilization games or other games of this price. And that just makes it hard for me to look at this and be like, sure. And I wouldn't back it at the $80 level and just get none of the plastic, you know, like,
sure.
You're asking me $80 for what is probably a $50 game or $150 for what is a $150 game. But I don't really know anything about it. So I don't know. That's where I'm at. I would love to have played this before. If this was a game that already existed and I could try it and then make this decision to like upgrade it and get a better version of it, I'd be all about it. But just like as a brand new thing on Kickstarter, I think I'm just getting tired of these games coming in at like $150, $200 and it's being like, give us all the money. You know, it's too much.
Yeah, I think there, again, this is another discussion that we need to have on another episode about Kickstarter and the benefit and the poison that comes along with like, hey, we're putting a game out on Kickstarter, so why not, you know, just put the most outrageous components in it because you're going to buy it once. Don't you want to buy it with all the great stuff? And of course we do. We absolutely want to buy it with all the best stuff. And of course, if it's a Civilization game, we want all the wonders. We want to see the map covered with amazing, amazing things. But again, like you said, we haven't played the game. So the financial investment into something like this is very high based upon something we have not played. Now,
right.
I do, again, there is some really problematic things with the colonization, you know, themes, but his game Empire's Age of Discovery just mechanically is one of the best games out there just for, right. for that kind of role. So I do trust the designer here. I do trust the company here, but the 2-hour time limit and how we could see things were kind of cut here and there in order to make the 2 hours. But also, like you said, there's at least another $50, $60, $70 on this game just for the plastic components that honestly are just, you know, they're just placeholders, right?
Right.
I think about Mare Nostrum Empires from Academy Games, and that does have an upgraded pack with their little plastic, and that was a Kickstarter way back in the day. It's the same area. It's definitely an empire building game. There is obviously mythology added to it as well, but that's a game that I always felt like really did have all the elements. It doesn't play in under 2 hours, but it does have the feel of that. So I think, Anthony, you know, whereas, you know, Marvel United X-Men you know, was one of those things where it was all about the plastic and we could kind of justify that. At least I could as a big X-Men fan. And I did back the whole enchilada, the uncanny version of this, which I will regret later, but I did do it. I think in this case, I think in this one rare case, despite the great company, despite the designer, I think, in fact, you have talked me out of buying or backing Mosaic, A Story of Civilization, my friend. You've done it.
I did actually do it.
You actually did a thing. I was this close to backing it. You pulled me out. Woo!
Oh. I did. Yes. I think I pulled myself out, too, because when you sent this link over, I was like, ooh, it's a Civ game by Glenn Drover. I want it.
It was an instant back and just, yeah. So I hate to do it because this is going to be a great game. And again, it's going to look gorgeous on the table with all the extra stuff. All right, you talked me out of it. Let's stop talking about it before I back it. Damn. All right, so that's everything for us. Just in the nick of time. Until next time, this is Chris.
Hey, and this is Anthony.
And we'll save you all a seat at the table. Take care, everyone.